From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we talk with cinematographer and climber David Brashears about shooting an IMAX film on Mount Everest. In 1996, Brashears was making the film when a freak May blizzard killed 8 climbers. Brashears put down his camera to help with the rescue efforts and later completed his climb to the summit. His new IMAX film opens in theaters this month. Also, film director Stanley Donen, who co-directed Singing in the Rain. At the upcoming Academy Awards, he'll be given an honorary Oscar for what the Academy calls a body of work marked by grace, elegance, wit, and visual innovation. And film critic John Powers reviews The Big Lebowski. That's all coming up on today's archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Police in Newington, Connecticut, say a gunman opened fire at the state lottery headquarters there this morning, killing 4 people and then killing himself. According to officials, he was a disgruntled employee. They say he shot 3 workers in the building, then chased a 4th outside and gunned him down in the parking lot. According to a state union official, one of the dead was the president of the state lottery. British au pair Louise Woodward will be back in court Monday. A hearing to determine the fate of the 20-year-old accused of killing a Massachusetts infant was canceled this morning because of a fire in the courthouse building. NPR's Tovia Smith reports from Boston.
After waiting months to find out whether she would be sent back to prison or whether she'd be allowed to return home to her family in England, Louise Woodward will have to wait just a little bit more. Woodward wants Massachusetts Supreme Court to overturn her conviction and clear her name. Prosecutors want the court to reinstate the jury's murder conviction that a judge later reduced to manslaughter. Just minutes before Woodward's hearing was about to begin, an electrical fire caused an evacuation of the court building. 5 people suffered minor injuries, including 3 electrical workers, a court officer, and 1 prisoner. Louise Woodward herself avoided the mob of reporters gathered here as she left. She'll be back in court Monday morning. As her attorney said, it will be yet another weekend spent worrying. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
Scott Ritter resumed his work today. The American weapons expert toured suspected weapons sites in Iraq for several hours without any apparent interference. In January, the Iraqis prevented him from taking part in the inspections, claiming he was a spy. The Iraqi non-cooperation sparked a confrontation with the U.N. that could have led to war, but for an agreement reached between Iraq and the U.N. Secretary General. The Labor Department says the nation's unemployment rate fell 0.1% last month to 4.6%. NPR's John Itzde reports.
The unemployment rate matched the 24-year low reached in November of last year. Meanwhile, non-farm businesses added 310,000 workers to their payrolls. That's more than economists had expected. Catherine Abraham, commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, said several factors contributed to the strong jobs picture in February. Low mortgage rates, which are creating demand for housing, and a mild winter, which has allowed construction to continue, both boosted demand for construction workers. Those low mortgage rates are also sparking refinancing activity and raising employment in the financial sector. However, manufacturing jobs fell for the first time in 5 months in February. Average hourly wages increased a strong 0.6% to $12.60 an hour. The average wage is up 4.1% from a year ago. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street this hour, the Dow is up 77 points at 85.22 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 26 points. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, part of the reason the trading is so heavy today is that bargain hunters are moving in to buy up the technology stocks that took such a beating yesterday. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
The market is being supported by the notion that interest rates will remain stable. Although this morning's report on February employment showed overall job growth was stronger than expected, manufacturing employment declined. Analysts say that could be an early sign that the Asian financial crisis may still slow the economy later this year. Indeed, there was a warning from Motorola that earnings will be disappointing because of slow sales of semiconductors and pagers in Asia. The market's advance is being led by drug stocks, along with computer software, regional telephone, and diversified healthcare issues. I'm Doug Krisner.
The financial markets in South Africa received disappointing news today. Standard & Poor has downgraded the country's credit worthiness to stable, down from positive. The rand slumped to its weakest level against the dollar in several weeks. Learning Company Inc., a maker of educational computer software, is buying rival Mindscape Inc. for $150 million in cash and stock. Learning Company officials say the two companies combined earned the most in U.S. software sales in January. Mindscape is now owned by Pearson PLC. That's a British company that also publishes the Financial Times newspaper and produces the Baywatch TV series. The nation's largest hospital company announced this morning its first quarter earnings will be better than analysts had expected. Chairman and CEO Dr. Frist Jr. says he expects earnings will be up to 35 cents a share. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. Everest has exerted its psychic pull on mountain climbers through the century, and many have died attempting to scale its treacherous terrain. In recent years, amateur climbers have signed on to expeditions to scale the forbidding, dangerous, oxygen-poor environment. In May 1996, 8 climbers were killed while trying to descend the mountain during a sudden freak blizzard. This was the story documented by journalist and climber John Krakauer in his best-selling book, Into Thin Air. David Brashears was also on Everest during that blizzard, making a movie using a large-format IMAX camera. His team suspended filming to assist in the rescue efforts. They eventually returned to their expedition and reached the top of Everest. Brashears is a veteran climber and 4-time Emmy Award winner. He's made 18 trips to the Himalayas and has climbed to the top of Everest 4 times. His IMAX film about Everest opens this week in New York and Boston and in other cities later this spring. National Geographic published a book about his expedition called Everest, Mountain Without Mercy. David Brashears told me about the physical challenges of climbing Everest. He says that at high altitudes, breathing is like running on a treadmill while inhaling through a straw.
It's impossible for me in any film or any book to convey to someone who hasn't been there what it's really like to be at those elevations, 26, 27,000 feet, where we're breathing about 1/3 or 1/4 of the oxygen that we're breathing here in these studios at sea level. And it's about a profound kind of lethargy and feeling tired. And lying in your tent at 26,000 feet and knowing you have to get ready to go to leave your tent on for the summit day and looking at your boot and saying, I need to put that boot on. And 5 minutes later, you're still looking at that boot. And then maybe you've picked up that boot. And then maybe, you know, you eventually get it on. It's just a profound kind of lethargy.
Well, it sounds like everything is in slow motion.
Yeah, it is. It is. And we did it a considerable amount of what we call psychometric testing this year for NOVA. And we were administered tests, pages and pages of tests over the radio. And two things happen the higher we go. The accuracy of your responses decreases, but much more dramatically, the speed of your responses decreases. So you do start to live in a state, like you've just described, a somewhat slow motion state. You're not thinking as quickly. It's not to say you don't think as clearly at times. In my tests from sea level to the summit, I had a 97 or 98% accuracy rating. But I slowed down so I could think more clearly. Other members of our team taking these same psychometric tests, if they tried to respond in the same speed, then the accuracy went down greatly. So it seems that if you can think virtually as clearly, but much more slowly.
Well, and that's because at those altitudes, there's just much less oxygen that's getting to the brain. Even when you're wearing face masks, can that make up for the decrease in oxygen?
Well, let's describe it like this. That oxygen-deprived state is called hypoxia. And that's basically the state you're in whenever you're above 24,000-25,000 feet on Everest, with or without supplemental oxygen. It's your body's oxygen starved. You're wearing supplemental oxygen, but it's mixed with ambient air. You generally put on or start using supplemental oxygen, which is bottled oxygen, above 26,000 feet. But it's not a closed system.
Mm-hmm.
It's you still are relying predominantly on the ambient air. The flow rate, if you can imagine this, in volume is only 2 liters per minute. You know, you inhale and exhale at least 2 liters of volume in every breath. So 2 liters of nearly pure oxygen is trickling into that mask per minute to be mixed in with the ambient air. So it does, in effect, place you lower on the mountain, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 feet lower than if you weren't wearing and using supplemental oxygen. But the other important factor to remember, and it's a more complicated concept, is that the partial pressure is very low up there, meaning while you are able to breathe this extra oxygen, these extra oxygen molecules coming from your bottled oxygen, the barometric pressure is so low that it's not entering your system at the same pressure as oxygen at sea level.
And that, of course, explains then why things take so long, why you have to move so slowly. And it seems to me why so many people have such a hard time at those upper levels on Mount Everest, because of just the sheer difficulty of breathing.
Well, that's a large part of it. But you have to look at a couple of other things to understand the whole picture and what's actually happening to one's body up there, because it's quite extraordinary when you really examine it. For instance, let's say you're at the high camp. It's 26,000 feet, Camp 4 on the South Col, and you've acclimatized for 4 or 5 weeks. That's how long it takes to get ready to be able to climb at those elevations. Now, and you're going to leave for the summit that night. Well, from our research last spring, we found out that by the time you reach the summit of Everest, you've gone nearly 60 hours on 3 to 4 hours of sleep. So you're incredibly sleep deprived. And that is because sleep apnea or interrupted breathing or just the inability to get good rest is a symptom of hypoxia. Once you leave the lower camps and you reach Camp 3 and Camp 4, there really is no good sleep. There's little cat naps, 2 or 3 hours at a time. On top of that, you're severely dehydrated. Once you get up there, you lose your appetite, and you can't eat and you can't drink well. So you're having maybe a half a liter of water or a quarter of water in a day, when you should be drinking, on the recommendation of the high-altitude physiologist, 4 to 6 liters. Then you're malnourished, because also those last few days, you're not eating well. In fact, a lot of people don't eat well in general on expeditions. It's not uncommon for people to lose 25 to 30 pounds. So that's the big picture.
Let's talk a little bit about this IMAX camera that you had built specifically for this expedition in the spring of 96 up Mount Everest. Now, normally an IMAX camera weighs about 80 pounds. You had one designed to weigh much less and obviously designed for these kinds of conditions. Tell us about some of the specifics then of this IMAX camera that you had designed to take up on top of Mount Everest.
Okay, well, they had to start with a 70-pound camera. And they reduced the weight to 42 pounds. And what that meant was we had a camera box, which weighed around 26 pounds. That's the body. We had a magazine loaded with film, which is about 10 pounds. So now we're at 36 pounds. And then we had lenses and batteries, which weighed 8 pounds. And that's what we took to the summit. But the interesting thing about shooting on Everest in the IMAX format was that it uses 500 feet of film. That's 4.5 pounds of film in 90 seconds.
So you have to choose your shots very carefully.
Yes, Yes, it uses 5.6 feet of film per second. Now, I grew up in a format, 16-millimeter mm-hmm. format, where 400 feet of film, a pound and a half of film, lasted 11 minutes. So I had to make this great leap of a format where I could basically, you know, leave the camera running and it wouldn't for a minute, and it wouldn't make or break us. But if I left, you know, you had three shots in this format per roll, and then you had to take the camera apart, unwrap this mechanism, reload it, and it was elaborate thing to load, and you had to be done barehanded.
Why did you want to take an IMAX camera? Why not just get a regular old video camera, film camera, and go from there?
A simple answer to your question is Greg McGillivray of McGillivray Freeman Films, one of the preeminent producers of IMAX films in the world, came to me and said, David, we have this project. We want to make a film on Everest in the IMAX format, and we want you to get that camera to the top. And at first, I said no. I tried to convince him, let's just shoot it in IMAX format up to 26,000 feet, which would be reasonable, and then we'll just shoot the top in 35, and on that very, very large screen, you can do kind of a form of what we call letterboxing and just project the 35-millimeter image in the center of that big screen. And he said, but wouldn't that be anticlimactic to get people to the top of Everest and just show them this little picture? Because you can't blow up a 35-millimeter image to fit an IMAX screen. They're 90 feet high and 110 feet wide, and the grain would be the size of golf balls, the grain of the film. But you want to know the reason why I really, really decided to do it? It's because I've been filming in the Himalayas for 16 years and working really, really hard to bring back these images. And these wonderful, beautiful peaks, the majesty and grandeur of which you cannot imagine, are being seen by people on a 17, 18-inch, 20-inch TV screen. So for the first time in my career as a filmmaker, I had the opportunity to bring back film images that would be projected. Not only projected onto a screen, but the largest screen in the world.
My guest is climber and filmmaker David Brashears. We're talking about climbing and filming on Mount Everest. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to mountain climber and filmmaker David Brashears. Let's get back to this trip again, this very well-documented, fateful trip in the spring of 1996. You were accompanying this expedition up Mount Everest. When did you begin to see that this particular climb was headed for trouble?
Well, the first thing that happened that was will cause a sense of foreboding in our group was the day that all those climbers, Rob Hall's group, Scott Fisher's group, the Taiwanese, and some others were headed from Camp 3 to the South Col. A young Taiwanese climber slipped at Camp 3 and fell 80 feet.
And died.
He was hurt, and they put him back in the tent, and his leader elected to go on without him. My Sherpas descending from the high camp found him now incapacitated. They started to help him down. They got him 1,000 feet, and then he did die. We refused to believe he was dead. The Taiwanese were very inexperienced and incapable of helping him. So we went out, Ed Viesters, Robert Schauer, and myself, hoping to find a man unconscious. And instead we found this Taiwanese climber dead on the ropes, and we brought him down. And that's a very disturbing thing to have to do. We didn't know him. We didn't know his name. He had died basically alone because he didn't know the Sherpas who were surrounding him. They were the Sherpas from my team, not from his team. He shared no language with them. And we felt very, very bad about that. And bringing him down was tough. We had to lower him down some ice cliffs, and I guided his body down. But at the same time, all these people, 38 or 40 people, were headed for the high camp. And that was when I just had a bad feeling that things were a little bit out of control on this mountain.
Describe for us the bad weather that came in. And, of course, this was after some of the people made it to the top of Mount Everest and began their climb down, and this storm came up. Describe for us what a storm like that sounds like, what it feels like.
Well, I can, because I have been in storms like that, although I wasn't in that storm. But I'll set the stage for you. They have now been going 60, 65 hours with 3 or 4 hours of sleep. They've been on the go that day 18 hours by nightfall with nothing to drink, nothing to eat. They've run out of oxygen, so they're hypoxic, and they're heading down, or they're more hypoxic than normal. And a storm strikes at the same time that darkness overcomes them. So you have a very, very, very bad situation. First of all, the onset of darkness is always demoralizing and disorienting, even to a very experienced climber.
You literally don't know where you are on the mountain?
No, you can, but who wants to be out on a great peak at 28,000 feet without light? And maybe you have your headlamp, you can see 6 feet. So on top of that, the wind starts to howl, and it's a fierce roar up there when that wind blows, because it's not an ordinary wind. It's a jet stream wind. And it starts to blow snow horizontally. Snow that's blowing so thickly that your headlamp can't penetrate more than 15 or 20 feet of it. So it's dark. If your headlamp is still working, you have this limited visibility, no landmarks. You have to take off your goggles. They're dark goggles to keep out the sun. You can't wear them at night unless they're clear. You can't walk into the wind because it stings and pelts you, the surface of your eyeball. And it's just a terrible situation to be in, out late on a peak in a very, very high wind in snow. It's chaotic.
Where were you in relation then to the climbers that were coming down the mountain? Where were you set up?
We were at Camp 2. We'd been higher, but we didn't like a lot of things, and we went down to wait. We had a strong team, an experienced team. We could climb up 2 or 3 times on a summit attempt and still have the energy and resources to try again. Once they came down and we knew what had happened, of course, we abandoned, without a moment's thought, all of our filmmaking efforts. We never turned the camera on once during the tragedy. And we went back up to Camp 3 and helped survivors coming down. And then two members, Ed Viesters and Robert Schauer, went up to 25,000 feet and met Beck Weathers, who was being helped down by Todd Burleson and Pete Athens.
Yeah, and Beck Weathers is the physician from Texas who was rescued and managed to survive through, I guess, what, most of the night, although barely survive. Terrible frostbite, lost his nose, lost a hand, lost some fingers because of how he had to literally try to survive that night.
Yes.
One of the other leaders, Rob Hall, was stuck up on the mountain, actually died on the mountain, but he was in radio contact. Did you actually talk with him?
Yes. When we woke up that morning at Camp 2, knowing when we went to bed the night before that Rob was struggling with Doug Hansen at 28,700 feet, when we woke up the next morning, we found out the terrible scenario which was Doug had died, Andy was missing, and Rob was still stuck at 28,700 feet in a fierce wind. And we did talk to him. Mostly it was Ed Viesters, who knew him much better than I did. And he tried and tried and tried to coerce him and exhort him to get up and start moving. But then we had to start moving back up the mountain ourselves to help people who were coming down well below Rob.
And what did his voice...
It was really... Oh, those were really sad moments.
Yeah.
Rob's voice was very weak. He was trying to be brave. It was the kind of man he was. He wasn't complaining, but it was very hard to listen to him because everything that had happened, you know, the effort of climbing Everest, the effort of trying to save Doug, the effort of having spent that terrible night there exposed, was apparent in his voice. And I never really told anyone then, but when I heard his voice, and I just didn't think he had a chance unless the Sherpas reached him.
It sounded like a dying man's voice. He was dying.
It just sounded, it just sounded like he had no energy, you know, that he... I sensed that he didn't have the energy to save himself. And that's why later in the day when we heard, as we made our way back up to Camp 3 through a radio link, we no longer had direct contact, when we heard that the Sherpas going to rescue Rob had turned around, we knew that was it, you know? Mm. We knew he would never survive another night.
That's filmmaker and mountain climber David Brashears. We'll talk more about climbing Mount Everest in the second half of the show. I'm Artie Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with David Brashears, and we'll talk with legendary filmmaker Stanley Donen, whose body of work will be recognized at this year's Academy Awards. And film critic John Powers reviews The Big Lebowski. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. Let's continue our conversation with mountain climber and filmmaker David Brashears about Mount Everest. His IMAX film about a 1996 expedition to Everest summit just opened in New York City and Boston and will visit other cities later this spring. National Geographic published a book about the climb and the film called Everest, Mountain Without Mercy. Brashears told us about helping with the rescue efforts when a violent storm erupted on Mount Everest, killing 8 climbers. He and his team helped the survivors get back to camp. Now, what kind of deliberations did you and your crew go through once this rescue was taken care of? You still had a film to make. Did you have any second thoughts? Did you think, well, maybe based on all the terrible things that have happened, we should go back and perhaps come back to this mountain another time? Or did you just say, let's go. We're here. Let's go.
Well, no, we didn't say that at all. In fact, it was a very difficult time for me. I was the leader of the team as well as the director and of the film. And we had a very moving and traumatic memorial service at base camp. And then all the team started to leave, so we felt quite lonely.
Yeah.
The wind continued to howl up there. The weather forecasts were all very bad, and I knew I could not demand, nor would I, that my team go back up that mountain. But I did know I could order everyone home and say, enough is enough. Why take any more risks? But that wasn't anything I would do either. It had to be more democratic than that. And so we talked about it. We all did a lot of soul searching. There was a lot of sadness. There was fear of going back up, knowing we would have to pass Rob Hall and Scott Fisher, our friends frozen on the trail, maybe Doug Hansen, maybe Andy Harris. But we did decide that our only obligations were to ourselves, not to the film. There was no pressure put on us from the executive producer, who we had daily contact with via satellite telephone. So we all said, we're professionals. We've had an apprenticeship. We've earned our stripes. Ed Wiester said, Everest is not a death sentence. We can climb it safely. And so as climbers, with a love for that mountain and a love for high places, we went back up. And we decided, as we're going back up, we might as well continue filming.
And when you pass the bodies, the dead bodies of some of the party, some of the members of this party, some of the leaders, I know some of you sat with them and talked with them or just sat with them on the mountain. Did you do that?
Well, both Ed and I did. Ed was much closer to Rob than I was. He'd done many peaks with him. It was very, very hard for Ed. He'd known Scott as long as I had, 20 years, spent more time with Scott than I had. He'd known Rob not nearly that long, but they were very close from being on trips together. When we first passed Scott, it was at night with our headlamps, and I was just startled when all of a sudden there was a person in blue lying on the ground in front of me. But both Ed and I were far ahead of the team when we reached Rob on the south summit. And then Ed had to leave, and I had to wait 40 minutes for my team. And I just sat there. I really didn't know what to do, because there he was on his side in the snow. His hand was out and exposed in half of his body, and mostly I was just perplexed. You know, I was, because of what I've mentioned earlier in the program, there's not a lot of room for emotions up there. You're just simply incapable of it. Your body doesn't have the energy or the space for it. And I just said, I was thinking, Rob, how could this have happened? You know, and it was hallowed ground to me. You know, I just sat there.
Did you photograph any of these bodies as you passed them?
Yes, some members of our team did. And I'm glad you asked that, because those were specific requests from the families that we would bring back pictures. I think it helps them deal with it. You can see how they died, the position they were in, and it provides something very, very concrete in your mind. But I'm also very pleased to say that we've received many, many offers from magazines with many thousands of dollars, and we have not allowed one of those pictures to be published, and of course you don't see them in our book. That's a there is a picture of somebody in our book that was on the trail from another expedition. It's not from one of our members, but we did take pictures, and we have not allowed them to be used by any form of media.
There's been a lot of publicity about this particular climb, a television movie, several books, your IMAX film coming out. Do you see this as a cautionary tale? Do you hope that those foolhardy people who think that they can climb Mount Everest when they really have no business on the mountain might turn back, might think twice?
You know, I've thought a lot about that, and I don't think that's going to happen because Everest was starting to be this worn-out, old, everyman's mountain. And it was no longer something you could walk into a cocktail party and chink your glass and I've climbed Everest. But now it's the killer mountain again. It's the mountain without mercy.
Right.
Now, if you go out and climb Everest, people are going to talk about it because they've read the books. They've seen the movies. So, for a mountain that had kind of been knocked off of its pedestal years ago in terms of it being an elite special achievement, it's now been placed back on its pedestal. And I don't think that any of these books or any of these movies are going to do anything but heighten the aura and the prestige of climbing Everest.
So you think there'll be more traffic, more climbers working their way up to that
summit?
There
were just as many this year. I was there this year,
yeah.
A year later. And this year, five people died. And you know what? They all died climbing too late into the day.
Interesting.
Once again.
Interesting.
It's always happened, and it's going to continue to happen. And all we've had here was a big accident that was well-publicized in 1996.
Well, David Brashears, I want to thank you very much for joining us on the show today. Thanks very much.
It's been my pleasure.
Mountain climber and filmmaker David Brashears. His IMAX film about climbing Mount Everest opens in New York and Boston this week and in other cities later this spring. This is Fresh Air. The co-director of Singing in the Rain, Stanley Donen, will be presented an honorary award at this year's Academy Awards ceremonies on March 23rd. In a moment, Donen will tell us about filming this scene.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart and I'm ready for love. Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. Come on with the rain, I've a smile on my face. I'll walk down the lane with a happy refrain. Just singing, singing in the rain. Dancing in the rain. I'm happy again. ¶¶ in the rain.
Gene Kelly gave Stanley Donen his big break. Kelly chose Donen to be his assistant in a Broadway production of Best Foot Forward. Soon after, when they were both in Hollywood, Kelly brought the 19-year-old Donen to Columbia Pictures to work on Cover Girl, the movie that made Kelly a star. Kelly and Donen went on to co-direct the films On the Town, It's Always Fair Weather, and Singin' in the Rain. Donen also directed Fred Astaire in Royal Wedding and Funny Face. Donen's other films include Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, The Pajama Game, Damn Yankees, Charade, Two for the Road, and Bedazzled. Donen was sometimes called the boy wonder of MGM for his ability to choreograph scenes that had his stars dancing with a cartoon character, dancing on the ceiling, and he even filmed Gene Kelly dancing with himself. Terry Gross spoke with Stanley Donen in 1996 and asked him about the rain and the puddles in his most famous production number.
People believe these things happen spontaneously. Certainly dance numbers are anything but spontaneous. They're worked out in great detail over quite a long period of time. And so we decided where, how, what he would dance, how he would dance, how quickly he would dance, what the steps were, where he would be. We rehearsed on the street and so on, and we said, he'll splash in a puddle here. Well, there had to be a puddle there, so we had to chop out the cement and make a little hole, and then it would fill up with water, and he would splash in that puddle there. And since dance is very specific, and when you do it the same way every time, you end up in the same spot, we placed the puddles where they were necessary.
Did you make the temperature of the water warm so that Gene Kelly's muscles wouldn't be a problem?
No, yeah. On the contrary, it was so hot in there. It would have been nice if the water had been cool. We were in midsummer, and we were under black canvas, so in the bright daylight. We didn't shoot it at night in real night. And the sun beating down on a black canvas overhead with the water pouring down on it was like a sauna in there.
Hmm.
Would have been better to have refrigerated water in that case.
Now, you work with Gene Kelly. You also work with Fred Astaire on the films Royal Wedding and Funny Face. Now, did you have a different approach to shooting each of them since their approach to dance was different?
Yes.
Could you describe the difference in shooting them?
Well, because Gene's movements are basically athletic, and the force of the movement is important to get the thrill of watching him dance, it's harder to produce that on film because film is not able to get forceful movement because it's only a two-dimensional medium. And you need two eyes to see sharp, hard, forward and back or sideways movement. You need three dimensions. And therefore, I tried to make up for that lack in the way I photographed it, which meant trying to make it a more dynamic move by the placement or movement of the camera or lack of movement of the camera. With Fred, you want to get the delicacy of the movement. So it's another way of focusing the eye in this two-dimensional medium on his physical, you know, subtle movements.
There's a dance scene I want you to talk about that's very mysterious when you see it. It's the dancing on the ceiling sequence, the sequence that your biography is named after. This is a Fred Astaire dance number from Royal Wedding. Yeah, from Royal Wedding. So, he dances on the floor and the walls and the ceiling on this. What did you do to create that illusion?
We had to build a room inside a wheel or a barrel, if you like, which turned slowly, and in which the camera turned with the room, as well as the lights and everything in the room. And its turning had to be so controlled and gentle, both in timing and in movement, that the things didn't shake or didn't throw Fred Astaire around, and the camera had to be fixed to its position so it turned exactly as the room did, and so did the lights. Otherwise, you would see the room turning. As the lights stayed still, you'd see shadows moving and so on. And then the wall, if we were now going to Fred dancing from the floor to the side wall, slowly the side wall becomes the floor, and he's actually dancing on that floor, which is now the wall of the room. But since the camera turns with it, the camera doesn't know that the set has moved in that sense. It doesn't see outside the room, so to the camera, it's still the side wall, and it looks like Fred has actually gone to the side wall, and that's repeated on the ceiling, the other side, and so on.
So did the choreography have to be done in such a way as to coincide with the turning of the room?
Yes, and the turning of the room had to coincide with the choreography and so on. They had to marry each other, and that only could happen with trial and error.
You say in your biography that the most difficult part in a film musical is making that transition from talking into dancing or talking into singing. And I could see how that would be the most difficult the most difficult part. What are some of the ways you've gotten around that in production numbers to try to make a smooth transition?
Well, we try any number of ways. In the number we were just talking about, in All the World to Me is the name of the song where he dances around the room, you hear him singing, but actually his lips aren't moving in the beginning. So it's almost as though his singing is an underscoring of the scene. And then after the verse of the song, he starts theoretically singing it with his mouth. So that's one technique. There are numbers of ways I've tried to do it. I've tried it sometimes with the characters back to the camera. You hear him singing, but you don't see him singing. Sometimes in Singing in the Rain, we had a little vamp which was written, which sort of eased him from dialogue into song. The vamp ahead of the song was written by Roger Edens. Most people are familiar with it. It goes do 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 do. That little vamp. He sings that, and that seems to bridge the moment.
Yeah, and in Moses Supposes, they start
in Moses Supposes,
about
they're
that
talking
before, yeah.
the lyric. That's right, and then the music joins the talk. So there are, I hope, endless ways of avoiding a catastrophe at that moment.
Now, I want to ask you about your musical Funny Face, which starred Fred Astaire as a fashion photographer, and Audrey Hepburn as a young woman who is kind of bullied into becoming a fashion model.
Antagonistic to fashion.
Yes, yes. And she really wants to be a kind of beatnik. and anyways, they, of course, fall in love, you know, Hepburn and Fred Astaire, although he's really much older than she is, which isn't spoken about in the film. But how are they paired together, Astaire and Hepburn?
By our casting? We just thought who are the best people to play these parts? Fred Astaire and Audrey Hepburn, and lo and behold, we got them. That was the unbelievable part of it. We got Audrey Hepburn after a great deal of trouble, because when we sent her the script, she said yes, she would like to be in the movie, but we prepared the script at MGM. MGM couldn't get, she was under contract to Paramount, and MGM could not get Paramount to lend Audrey Hepburn's services to MGM to make Funny Face. So the picture looked like it was a dead issue when it occurred to me and Roger Edens to see if we could get Paramount to buy the picture and take us to Paramount to make the picture. They had Audrey. So we went to MGM and said, can we try to get Paramount to buy the situation from you? And the studio said, well, if they'll pay us enough money, yes. Although they were going to lose it all. Nevertheless, Paramount paid them and borrowed Roger Edens and me to go to Paramount to make the picture. That way we got Audrey Hepburn. Once we had the picture at Paramount, we asked Fred Astaire, would he like to make this picture with Audrey Hepburn and us? And Roger knew him well, and I had directed him previously in Royal Wedding. And he said he'd love to, so that's how we got them together.
No, Audrey Hepburn, who wrote the introduction to your biography, says that she was so nervous about dancing with Astaire, she actually lost her breakfast. She threw up the morning of the first performance together. Were you aware of how nervous she was?
Yes. It is terrifying to work with Fred Astaire, particularly if you're a dancer, as Audrey Hepburn was a very trained dancer. So Fred Astaire was everyone's idol, and suddenly she's thrust into being his equal. Of course, it's terrifying for her.
And was he...
Very gentle, very uh-huh. helpful, he had been through this with other people that were equally terrified of working with him. But he loved Audrey, as everyone did.
On March 23rd, Stanley Donen will receive an honorary award at the Oscars for a body of work the Academy said was marked by grace, elegance, wit, and visual innovation. The producer, director, choreographer spoke with Terry Gross in 1996.
Moses supposes his toes are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously.
But Moses, he noses, his toes aren't roses, as Moses supposes his toes to be.
Moses supposes his toes are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously.
A Moses is a mose.
A rose is a rose.
A toes is a toes.
Hoop-de-doody-doodle.
Moses supposes his toes are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously.
For Moses, he noses, his toes aren't roses, as Moses supposes his toes to be.
Coming up, The Big Lebowski. This is Fresh Air. Two years ago, filmmakers Joel and Ethan Coen had their biggest success with the film Fargo. They have a new film called The Big Lebowski, starring Jeff Bridges and John Goodman. Have the Coen brothers scored again? Our film critic John Powers has a review.
Back when Joel and Ethan Coen first hit it big with Blood Simple, one of their producers told me proudly, "These guys make movies for the hip wazee." He was right. The Coens' movies were filled with violent jokes, visual gags that called attention to their own cleverness, and characters that the audience could feel superior to. They appealed to an insider's smugness. With Fargo, however, they seemed to have matured. That movie had a newfound humanity, a tenderness even, and in Francis McDormand's small-town cop, an authentic moral center. Perhaps the Coens really did believe in something after all. Now comes The Big Lebowski, and the question is, was Fargo just an aberration? The movie is set in L.A. during the Gulf War. Jeff Bridges stars as Jeff Lebowski, otherwise known as the Dude, a bearded, long-haired 60s holdover who has no job and no ambition. He devotes his life to bowling and getting high. When he's not smoking dope, he's guzzling white Russians. When some crooks mistake him for a Pasadena millionaire, also named Jeff Lebowski, the Dude is thrown into a noir adventure that's quintessentially Coen-ish in its shaggy doggedness. Along with his best friend Walter Sobchak, a blustering Viet vet played by John Goodman, the Dude finds himself involved with a kidnapped socialite, a missing ransom payment, assorted goofy thugs, and a predatory feminist artist who's played by Julianne Moore. Through it all, the Dude wants nothing more than to get back to the lumpen life he loves. Hanging out, bowling with his buddies, and of course, getting stoned, man. Like their hero, the Coens have virtually no interest in the criminal events that surround the Dude. Rather, the movie is a loose, sloppy collection of cheap gags. The dude dropping a burning joint onto his lap, Walter braying profanities as he smashes in car windows, a rival bowler named Jesus, played by John Turturro, doing obscene hip-thrusting dances. Although The Big Lebowski boasts three or four big laughs, it's just crawling with mirthless jokes about things like urination, and it never comes close to proper comic timing. In fact, the movie itself seems stoned, as in the scene where the dude first meets the surly millionaire who shares his name.
I'm not trying to scam anybody here. I'm just...
You're just looking for a handout like every other... Are you employed, Mr. Lebowski?
Wait, let me explain something to you. I am not Mr. Lebowski. You're Mr. Lebowski. I'm the dude. So that's what you call me, you know? His dudeness or duder or, you know, El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
Are you employed, sir?
Employed?
Although The Big Lebowski made me long for the old-school craftsmanship of Cheech and Chong, the movie does feature a superb performance by Jeff Bridges, to my mind, our greatest working screen actor. Against the odds, Bridges triumphs over the cartoonish script and gives the scrofulous dude an inner life. He's a man-child whose sense of decency keeps struggling to make itself felt, only to be swamped by his addled desire to take it easy. Passive and pliant, he's akin to the tumbleweed we see at the beginning of the movie, being blown across the desert to L.A. Like David Letterman, the Coens have always had a weakness for making us laugh at everything in the name of nothing. When you try to pin down what The Big Lebowski is actually saying, you're told that you're missing the point, that the movie's being ironic. Yet there's a difference between irony anchored in real convictions. Think of Lenny Bruce's exposés of American hypocrisy and the kind of free-floating irony found here, where the details don't add up to anything. The dude and Walter are classic 60s stereotypes, the mellow hippie and the nutso Viet vet, and you may find yourself asking, are the Coens trying to say something about the 60s? At the end, you're still asking. And why does the action take place during the Gulf War? Is this a commentary on American apathy, since nobody in the movie seems to notice the war? Or was that simply when the brothers first wrote the script? There's just no way of telling. For in The Big Lebowski, the Coens are up to their old tricks. They've made a comedy so hip and knowing that it doesn't know where it stands on anything.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Danny Miller is the executive producer of Fresh Air. Audrey Bentham, Fred Snyder, and Al Banks are our engineers. Alan Tu directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the next generation of superweapons. We'll hear from Richard Preston, author of The Hot Zone, who writes in the latest New Yorker about the emerging threat of biological weapons. Join us for the next Fresh Air.